You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Hey Tommy, guess how many Nissan Z's I've owned in my life?
Zero.
No, three. So you can imagine how excited I was when we had the chance, well, I should say I had the chance to go and drive the brand new Z. It's no longer like a 240, a 350, a 300, ZX. It's now the Z.
Yeah, we need to have a conversation here at TFL about how we allocate the press trips, because that sounded like a really fun one.
Yes, but I've owned three of them, Tommy, so that's why I got to go on it. And in this podcast, we're going to be doing much more than that. We're also going to be talking about a trip you went on, Tommy. What did you go drive?
Well, I got to spend some time with the brand new Kia Sportage, but we're also going to talk about a bunch of other stuff like the C-Class.
Yep.
A few questions that you guys have asked over the past week. And some, you know, randomness here and there about how I got, like, really stuck in the mud in my Jeep. I thought we could talk about that as well.
Yeah, and then, of course, we have to introduce our new producer, Jay. Say hi, Jay.
How's it going, guys?
Jay's going to be helping us with questions and with a fun story I found on CNN this week, Tommy. I want to know just how important your cell phone is. In fact, is it important enough for you to, well, get it out of a toilet? That is, am I making that up, Jay?
No, you can't make this one up.
No,
this is pretty disgusting.
I know that's a real story that we're going to be discussing. So I want to know whether you would go and get your phone if you dropped it into a toilet. Not the kind you flush, but the kind that's at a campsite, because that's what this woman did. But we'll get to that. So should we start on the Z?
Yeah, let's do it. So you went to Las Vegas to drive the all-new Nissan sports car.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it's been a long time in the coming, right? I mean, first and foremost, it was 53 years now since the original Nissan 240, if I recall, Z was introduced. And here's a bit of trivia, Jay. Let's see if you know this question.
Okay.
Or Tommy, I'll open it up to both of you. In Japan, first of all, Jay or Tommy, what is a Z called?
It was the Fair Lady.
Fair Lady.
Okay.
Yep.
And why is it called the Fair Lady?
I don't know.
We're a lot younger than you are, Roman. We don't know these things.
Dude, come on. When this thing was introduced, I was like 5 years old or something.
No, so. You were in high school.
No, I was not.
What year was it introduced? Like 1940?
1970.
Okay.
Well, I mean, Tommy and I have an excuse. We just didn't exist.
Yeah, we were not alive. Yep.
All right. So, you know, the Fair Lady name, okay, came before the AZ, actually. In Japan, there was I believe it was a sports car that was also called the Fair Lady. And the reason for the Fair Lady, gentlemen, is the CEO of Nissan, actually Datsun at the time, right?
Datsun, yep.
Went to New York, and guess what Broadway show he watched?
My Fair Lady.
Exactly.
There you go.
And there it is.
That's where the name it actually came from, My Fair Lady.
It must have been a really good show for him to name a iconic sports
car. It just seems really goofy, because I think of My Fair Lady, I think of, like, I don't think of that. I'm pointing to the new Z.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Okay, so what did you think of the Z? What can you tell us about it?
Well, first and foremost, I think they nailed the styling. So what they tried to do is incorporate a little bit of the retro with those, like, LED round headlights. There you can see the old one compared to the new one. And then, of course, they gave it more power, gentlemen. 400 horsepower out of a twin turbo V6 and 350 pound-foot of torque, which is about, I think, 68 more horsepower than the outgoing model, which was a 370.
Well, one thing I didn't know, which you told me, which I thought was really interesting, is I thought this was an all-new car from the ground up, but you said it actually shares a lot of its chassis development from the old one.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it is a new car, but they did use a lot of the old chassis. So if you you know, liked or disliked the 370Z, which was a previous gen. That was the sixth generation. This is now the seventh generation of Z. Then you may not like or you may like this car. It really depends. They gave it a little bit of a wider tire and bigger shocks and better suspension to give it a little bit more track worthiness. And I did get to go on the track, and that video will be coming out. If you're listening to this today on Monday, that will be coming on May, I think it's 16th. So we've got a little bit of time before we can actually talk about what it's like on the track. But I did do a walk around, which is already on alltfl.com, Tommy.
Now, did they make the interior better than the old one? That was one of the big problems with the old one.
They did. So some of the switchgear is still shared.
Yeah, like it looks like the window switches and like the door handles, yeah, pretty similar.
Yeah, the door handle's the same as the old 370. You see the little rear view mirror switch?
Uh-huh.
You know, that's exactly out of any other Nissan product. But in general, the thing that really impressed me, Jay, as well, was guess what?
What
do you see there? What's so cool about that picture? What's the most important thing on that picture?
He had a manual transmission.
Exactly. He found it. Yeah. It comes with an automatic or manual, a 9-speed or a 6-speed manual. 9-speed automatic, 6-speed manual.
What does this little button do that has the shift pattern on it?
Oh, good question. You know, Jay? That's the fun button.
Overdrive feature?
Nope. Rev matching.
Oh, okay.
So it rev matches, which is really cool. And the best thing, guys, I got to do is they had the 370, then they had the manual version of the new vehicle and the automatic, and they got to do accelerations. So I was able to do a video where we went from 0 to 60 in the last generation, the new manual, and the new automatic, and that is also coming up on TFL Car. I can't wait to show you that one.
Yeah, gotcha.
Wait, what's this mean?
Well, I think every time you turn your head, you're going to lose your audio.
Oh, thank you for the...
No, I think it's a very cool looking car. I really like the changes they've done. I really enjoy the full digital instrument cluster. I think that's a nice improvement. And the seat design's pretty cool. The steering wheel looks very sporty and aggressive. But overall, it looks to be very attractive. I just can't wait to see what it drives like.
All right, so we're going to have a group discussion here, okay?
Okay.
And I was having this discussion with Alex from Alex on Autos as we were driving back from the new C-Class. And it's a really good discussion, and he's going to be having it on his podcast as well. So I thought, well, you know what? Let's we're not going to talk about the C-Class yet.
Oh, okay.
So let's talk about this. So they have not officially announced pricing on the new Z, but they have announced pricing in Japan. So in Japan, the new Z is going to cost just over 5 million yen, which translates to about $41,000 in America.
Okay.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good, don't
that's
you?
Fair.
Yeah, I do think that's fair. I do wonder if it's going to be more expensive for the U.S. market. So we'll have to find that out.
I would bet it's going to be less. That would be my guess.
Well, what's the discussion?
An informed guess.
What's the discussion that Alex wanted to have?
So the discussion that we're going to have is for $50,000 or less, which includes the new Z, what performance sports car would you gentlemen buy? So I'll start with you, Tommy, and then how about you, Jay? So let's talk about the cars that are on our list first. So just off the top of my head, the cars that are on the list are, well, let's go through it, guys. I mean, we can come up with this list. So obviously the Z, but get this, the Supra starts at over 50. So unfortunately, it's not on the list.
Well,
is that even for the base 2.0 engine?
I think so. Alex said I think it's more.
No, the 2 liter is a lot cheaper than the 3 liter.
Why don't we Google it? Why don't we find out?
The Supra 2.0 is actually very affordable for what it is. So let me get the exact price. $43,000. For the Supra 2.0.
So you could have the 2.0, but you couldn't have the 3.0, I bet. I bet you that's
3.0 is probably about another 10 grand.
Yeah. I would imagine so. Let's see. Supra 3.0 is 50-something.
Yeah. Yep, there it is.
So it's over. So the 2.0 has how much horsepower? It's probably, you know, not 400.
I don't want to get it wrong.
Okay.
2.0 starts at 43, 3.0 starts at 51, and the 2.0 has a 2-liter twin scroll single turbo. And where are the full specs here? Mechanical and performance. It has why has our internet decided to go so bad today? What is going on?
Because it's raining outside, Tommy.
Yeah, apparently it doesn't work when it gets wet. 255 horsepower.
Right. So I mean, you know, in Japan at least, for 41,000 you can get a 400 horsepower Z versus a 250 horsepower Supra.
Right.
And the Z, unlike the Supra, and this is once again good or bad depending on your point of view, is not shared with a BMW chassis or powertrain.
But keep in mind, there's a lot of other kind of more indirect competitors. Like you could get a hell of a Mustang GT for this price.
Yeah, so you can get a Mustang or Camaro.
Camaro SS, yeah, even a Challenger if you wanted something.
You could get a Challenger. You could also get a WRX.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So that's another one.
Yeah.
The Cadillac, one of the Black Wings is under 50K.
Probably the little one, right?
The little CT4. One. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, CT4.
That one's under 50K, so that is also a competitor.
Well, okay, Jay, I'm going to let you answer first. Okay. Which one of these would you go for?
There's still more. We haven't gotten them all. So.
Yeah, there is one actually I'm thinking of. It's a lot less powerful, but...
There's a Toyota 86.
Well, I was going to talk about those in the Miata, but those are kind of a class lower, wouldn't you say? From a horsepower and performance standpoint?
I'm just saying sports car for under 50K. We're not classing them. There's no particular classes. There's just a sports car under 50K. So now those both qualify, the Miata and the GR86. The WRX qualifies, of course. The Mustang, the Camaro.
Well, if you're talking WRX, so then you have to talk about like Golf R,
yep,
Golf GTI.
Yep, Golf R, Golf
count,
yep, they count as well. So there's like probably at least a dozen of these cars. I also think aren't there some like sporty A-class Mercedes that are under 50K? How about the BMW, the M2?
No, that's
going to be...
A 2 Series?
Maybe a 2. You could get like an Audi S3, I think.
Audi
right,
S3, definitely.
Definitely. That definitely would count.
45.
Yeah.
Tell me, what does the BMW M240i run for?
That's going to be more.
That'll be more, but he's right.
Yeah, that's going to be more. But you could probably get a base 2 Series for under the price... anyways, which of these, Jay, is sounding attractive to you?
Miata, all the way.
I agree. That's my choice.
It's affordable. It's fun. It's reliable.
Yep, I agree. That's
and
the choice.
You just can't go wrong. And but it's slow. Roman can't fit in it, so
it's. I don't
I
fit,
understand.
The problem, guys, for me is I don't fit in 3 of those cars. Actually, 4. I don't fit in the Supra. I don't fit in the Miata. I sort of kind of fit in the GR86, and I'm 6'2". And unfortunately, I don't really fit into this. I kind of sort of fit into this. It's a little bit bigger than the Supra, but once again, they made the roofline super low. And I just wish that Japanese would consider that there are people like my height and girth, Tommy, who do not like having their head hit the ceiling when they're driving a vehicle or leaning way back when they're driving it. How about you? Which car would you pick?
Miata. It's the best sports car in the world. You can't beat it. You know, it's cheap. You can
exactly.
pick up a Miata for 30 grand. You have 20 grand left over.
So Jay, Tommy went autocrossing this weekend. Want to tell us about that?
Not too much to talk about. Just driving around some cones for a full day. It was a ton of fun. But the Miatas, obviously they kill at autocross, but I just love them. I think they're really good value. They're a ton of fun. They're one of the lighter cars on the market, super tossable. They're very reliable, and it's just great. I mean, the thing is, this car is obviously much faster. It's kind of in a league above it.
It would kill it. This would kill
but
the Miata on the autocross.
You'll have, I'm not so sure about that.
I don't know.
Because a Miata was killing M2s. Basically, a stock Miata was just running circles around M2s at the autocross.
Okay, how about a track? Let's go a track.
On a track, yes, yeah. Be faster.
But not everybody buys a Miata to go fast. They buy a Miata to have fun.
Darn straight. And that is why I think the Miata is not going to be any less fun than the Z.
Well, I mean, they both have a lot of heritage, right? They've both been around a long time.
You can, by the way, get an M240 for under 50.
You can?
I thought so.
48,550.
The very base minimum M240i you can do.
Yep, that's true.
I think
true.
They're only all-wheel drive right now, Tommy. The rear-wheel drive is coming out this summer, supposedly.
If you want rear-wheel drive, you have to get a 230.
I'm be honest, I'm a huge Z fan. Like I say, my dad, your grandpa owned one, and then when he passed away, he left it to me. And then I've owned 2 others previous to that. The 300ZX Twin Turbo Guys is the favorite car I've ever owned, and I've owned probably too many to go through in one show. And it's funny, Tommy, I was thinking to myself, like, you know, we've been recently buying some of the cars that I wanted to buy or I've owned when I was a kid just to kind of relive them. And the one I've refused to buy is a 300ZX twin turbo because I've been afraid that it's going to wreck the kind of, you know, the image that I have of it, like don't meet your heroes again. So out of all those cars under 50K, I would love this car, but I just don't fit.
I will say if I wanted something a little bit faster, I would get the Mustang GT all day long.
How about you, Jay? Are you into the Camaro or Mustang?
Definitely the Mustang over the Camaro.
Yeah.
Because you can get that Mustang GT, the coupe, for what? A little over 30 with a 5.0?
Yeah, 6-speed manual transmission.
6-speed manual, kind of a bare bones All-American muscle car.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you know, there's
and
a new
we'll
one.
Break the bank.
There's a new one coming. So I always hate buying ones when there's a new one coming, right? We've seen spy photos of it. And the interior, we just rented it in
Yeah, but that was
Hawaii.
A rental car. And that thing's going to be.
It was pretty sad, Tommy.
That thing was roached. Of course it's going to be pretty
it
sad.
Was.
But I think a base GT Fastback starts at 37.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. Yeah.
The 5-liter Coyote. That's going to be a heck of a thing just to cruise around in. So if I wanted to go faster than the Miata, I would probably go Mustang.
But Roman, bear in mind that that 5-liter Coyote is probably not going to stick around after when the 7th generation Mustang arrives.
Yeah. That,
and they're going to hybridize it.
That
but
could
it's not
be
gonna
interesting.
Be just naturally aspirated. So like, this is the time to get that purest V8.
I do like the Supra 2.0,
Mustang.
Though. That's a fun car. Yeah, we're getting one today, I think.
What are we? The Supra 2.0?
Yeah.
We're not buying it. Just
well, no. We're getting a loaner one this week. And
we
I really, last time I drove it, I was really impressed with it. It's not very fast and it doesn't sound very good, but it is a fun car to cruise around in.
So none of you would even consider the Z, huh? And you're not going to have the hype problem that I have.
Yeah.
Especially you, Jay.
Thank you. Well, I haven't driven the new Z, so I can't consider it. I mean, I like the looks of it inside and out, but I mean.
You know, I'm just, the other thing too is, and this is just a weird personal thing I have, I'm not a big fan of V6 performance engines. I really
they don't sound good, do they?
I really like straight sixes. I love V8s and four cylinders, but I don't know. I just V6 and they just they don't do much for me.
We have a video with the exhaust note out there, so if you want to hear it. But yeah, a V6 never sounds well.
Well, unless you're like Alfa Romeo GT V6.
And I said that on purpose. It never sounds well. It always sounds a little sick to me, right? It sounds like it's got a bad cold. A V8 sounds much more healthy.
Yeah, I did like that. The other one that would be at the top of my list, though, is I'd probably get a GR86 over this as well.
Wow.
We just drove that recently, and that thing was awesome. They really did a good job on the
GR86. So on this program that we went on, right, in Vegas, we worked, me and Ian, our videographer, worked really hard to get all the videos done. And then they had kind of a typical, catered lunch. You know what that is. Like, you know, you want the beef or you want the chicken, right? Mm-hmm. So I was on my phone. I'm like, I think they have In-N-Out Burgers in Vegas, and they do. And there was one like 8 minutes away. So we drove a bright yellow Z to the In-N-Out Burger, and I got to say, it made quite the stir, gentlemen.
Really?
People were looking at it. People were pretty impressed. They were especially yellow. Yellow is one of those colors that you either love or hate. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, but this is not just any yellow. This is like
this is like
highlighter green,
it's
almost
fluorescent.
Yes, it's
glow in the dark.
Yeah, it's not a good yellow.
But people were looking at it. People were like,
"Well, sure, they would look at anything in that color."
There was a woman who walked up to me and she said her brother had owned one, and so she was curious about it. I mean, I think whenever you have an iconic car that, like, you know, either you've owned or somebody you knew has owned, it always creates a stir when a new version of it comes out.
All right, well, should we move on to the next segment?
Yes, let's talk about that story. So here's a question for you. And Jay, could you read this story? It was on CNN.
Yeah, this is...
Go for it.
A little disgusting, but I'll let you guys think about this.
Yep, because I want to know, here's a question I want to know. How important is your phone to you, and is it as important as it was to this woman? So read the story.
Okay, the headline is, Fire Crews Rescue Washington Woman After She Falls Headfirst Into a Toilet. Yeah. If you think hiking stinks, get a load of this. A woman was rescued by two fire crews after she fell headfirst into a vault toilet while trying to retrieve her cell phone at a park on Olympic Peninsula, Washington State. The woman in her mid-40s was using an outhouse on Mount Walker, which is a popular destination for hikers, apparently, earlier this month when the accident occurred, according to the local fire department. Basically, a vault toilet is a waterless, non-flush toilet usually placed at outdoor locations like campgrounds, so named because the toilets store waste in an airtight vault underground. Hmm. After dropping her phone in the toilet, the woman disassembled the seat and housing of the toilet in an attempt to reach it, the fire department said on Facebook. It gets better or worse. She used a dog leash to try to, quote, fish it out. Before using it to support herself as she tried to grab the phone. But the attempt failed and she slid into the toilet. Fortunately for her, after about 20 minutes inside the vault, she was able to find her phone and use it to call 911.
There you go.
The crews from the local fire department reported to the scene and they quickly pulled her to safety. According to the department, the uninjured woman was washed down and given... Tyvek suit to wear, but she declined any further medical treatment and continued on her way. The department said the patient was extremely fortunate not to be overcome by toxic gases or sustain injury.
So here's my question to you boys. If you dropped your phone into a vault toilet, how important is it to you? Was it important enough for you to actually do what this woman did, and that is reach down into one of these gross, disgusting toilets to retrieve it? Or would you just say, like,
Well, wouldn't you go out and, like, get some kind of implement to dig it out with, like one of those little bulb changers?
Yeah, but by that point, other people may have used it and gotten it, you know. I mean, I assume if you drop it, it's sitting on top of the...
Right.
On top of stuff we should
yeah, exactly.
Talk.
Yeah. Whereas if you run out to get an implement, there'll be other people.
You know, I think this is a generational thing.
Okay.
Because you were astonished by this story.
Yeah.
I, for one, was not that astonished by the story. Because I know people my age that do some truly amazing things to recover their phone from precarious situations.
So are you saying you would go in that toilet and get it?
I personally wouldn't, but I know people that have dropped their phones on roller coasters, right? And then they have to stop the rides to get it. I know people that drop their phones in the canyons and then they have to go into the canyon to get it. So I'm not – I think that maybe there's a little bit of a disconnect here between the generations.
All right, Jay, you're not my generation, and you're certainly not Tommy's. You're somewhere in between.
You're in the middle. Wait, were you astonished by the story, or were you kind of like, eh?
I think it's absolutely disgusting, and I would have just said, screw it. I'll get a new phone later, and I would have enjoyed hiking without anyone bothering me on my phone.
Yeah, but keep in mind, have you seen the prices on these phones?
I know.
I mean, iPhones are going to be $1,000 in some cases.
At least nowadays, yeah.
So you're also protecting your investment.
Well, I don't have an expensive smartphone, and it's probably for reasons just like that. I'm not expecting to drop into a toilet, but things happen.
Yeah, but don't you have like bank access on your phone? Don't you do like online banking?
Yeah,
I'd be
worried
about
that. It's all password protected.
Yeah. And has my fingerprint.
Well, who knows
when
a bit of solid something falls on it, maybe it'll go bzzz and then the password goes away.
Roman,
I don't know.
I wouldn't really be worried if my phone fell in a toilet, if somebody would fish it out just to get my bank password.
Yeah, that is the
I
least
just don't
of my
see
concerns.
That happening.
More concerned about the fecal matter on the phone.
I don't know if I could. The problem there is, look, I'd want the phone because like I feel like my life's on it, but I could never put that phone to my face again.
Well, here's the thing, though. Did you know they say
that's another point.
They say that your phone has more bacteria and diseases on it than a typical toilet seat.
And now it's going to have even more.
Yeah, now it's just got slightly more, so I'm not really sure. And new phones are mostly waterproof. Just clean that puppy off and off you go.
It's true. They are waterproof.
Yeah, they're water resistant.
And those little like disinfecting wipes are everywhere because of COVID nowadays.
And you know you can also wipe a phone as well now.
I've got it in a case. I would throw that case away.
So well, sure. So why did you bring this up? What does this have to do with cars?
Well, it has nothing to do with cars. But I was wondering how far you would go to actually retrieve a phone.
You were this astonished by the poop phone story.
I was. Yeah.
Huh.
I was. Like, how important have phones gotten?
You see,
to our lives?
I saw that, and I was like, eh. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Like, I can see, like, okay, my generation, right? We probably would have, like, dropped a wallet in there.
Right.
And wallet has money in it.
Sure.
And I would probably go in there to get the money because it's money, right? Mm-hmm. Depends how much money's in there. And credit cards.
Yeah.
But now all that stuff is actually on your phone.
But it's all password protected.
Okay.
And you can wipe your phone as well from your computer, typically, right?
I don't know. Can you?
Yeah. If you lost your phone, I could go into your...
You could
find my iPhone and wipe it.
How do you wipe my phone remotely?
Yeah, for sure.
All right.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, anyway, I think we've done enough of the phone. Let's talk about some more cars. Tommy, you got to go and drive the new Sportage.
I did. Yes. So the all-new 2023 Kia Sportage. It's a hugely popular vehicle for Kia. And they're actually, I don't know if they did it, but they were trying to set an all-time record this month for the most Sportages ever sold. So they actually introduced the Sportage a little while ago. It just hit dealers, I think in March, they were saying. But yeah, I drove the new one, and I also drove the hybrid model. So they've got two now. So the hybrid model's coming here shortly, and then there's also a naturally aspirated one.
And that video is now including driving impressions on alltfl.com, and I watched it, and I saw that you were doing a collab with Sofian.
Yes, we did a collab, and we took it off-road. They built out a pretty cool little off-road course, and we drove something called the X-Pro, which is the off-road model. Did you know? Actually, I didn't know this. There's been five generations of Sportage, and the first one, I think, was... one of the only vehicles, if not the only vehicle, what did they say, to complete both Baja and Dakar in the same year.
I did not know that.
And Kia Sportage?
The Kia Sportage.
What year was this?
This was the 90, I think they said 93. 3? It was like mid-90s. It was right when they launched it.
Yeah, it was probably the first one.
Yeah, so the first Sportage was this little itty-bitty tiny thing that looks like a Tupperware container. And apparently they competed both in Baja and Dakar in it.
Now, in case you're wondering who Sofian is, he's with Redline Reviews.
Yep.
So he's another YouTuber. I just wanted to get that out there. And how was it off-road, Tommy?
Well, it was surprisingly good. So the X-Pro has it has 8.3 inches of ground clearance. And then the X-Pro also has BFGs on it. So they gave it something called the Trail Terrain Tire, which is a pretty aggressive all-terrain for the car. So it was very, very cool that they actually went ahead and wanted to show us what it could do. So we went up some really steep hills, we went down some steep hills, did a lot of articulation, did some ground clearance testing, and it was pretty impressive for what it is. Now, the issue is the X-Pro gives you, like, the all-terrain tires, but it doesn't really give you all that much more in terms of technology. So it's not like you get any special modes, you don't get extra ground clearance, you don't get skid plates, so it really is a tire group. And then the question is, it's a $4,000 option up on top of like an X-Line, and is it really worth $4,000 for wheels and tires? I would probably say no, but yeah, it was good. And then of course the other weird thing is the X-Pro, the offered one, is only available in the naturally aspirated engine. And if you want the turbo model with the hybrid system, you can't get it in that cool model. But yeah, I drove the turbo hybrid, and they did something interesting. Just like the Tucson, they have a model that's not only a hybrid, but also turbo with a 6-speed automatic. So it's pretty cool.
You know, we got an email this morning, and I don't think Jay has seen this one yet, or you have. Have you seen it? Somebody wrote that they missed their Sportage. They sold their old Sportage and traded it in on a Subaru, and they were saying that their actually Sportage was better off-road than a Subaru.
I did see
really?
That.
Really?
Yeah.
But good news for them. There's plenty of Sportages out there.
Are
they want to go back.
I bring that up because I think people don't realize that Sportages are actually pretty good off-road.
Yes, they do. They are pretty good. Hmm. And I also want to point out something else interesting. I drove a hybrid with something called the Shadow Matte Gray Paint. And now you can get a Sportage with a matte paint job. So
wow.
I asked the product planner, I said, so what are the care techniques? Because you figure like a Sportage is going to be used in car washes and like by kids and that kind of thing. And I thought maybe it would be like more durable than like a Porsche matte paint job. Nope, you can't take it through automated car washes. You can't pressure wash it. You can't, there's a bunch of them. You can't let birds poop on it.
Yeah, good luck doing that.
Yes, and the Sportage. So if you want the matte paint job, there's a ton of care stuff you have to do. So to clean it, you have to wash it by hand with a soft touch cloth.
But Tommy, how much does the matte paint job cost?
It was only $600. So really it's pretty reasonable. But then your life is going to be revolving around keeping this matte paint.
All right, so do you guys know what the problem is with matte paint?
Well, if you rub up against it, it gets
Tommy
shiny.
Tommy just said it, pretty much.
Yes.
Yeah, it doesn't buff out, basically.
No.
Oh, this was actually the most interesting thing he told me, which I'd never even considered. Apparently, it's impossible to paint match matte paint. So if you get a door scratch on the driver's side door, you have to repaint the entire left side of the car. So you have to repaint the front fender, the driver door, the rear door, and the rear fender to get it all to match, right?
That must be terrible, just like with like little paint chips you get
Could
from
you
stones
imagine?
On the highway.
And the thing is, like, it's one thing being able to care for a matte paint job on like a high-end Porsche or high-end BMW, but on a Kia, that's pretty nuts.
Yeah, that 150,000-mile Kia with the matte paint is going to look pretty good.
150,000-mile, yeah.
So that's
used
a
one.
Really time-intensive $600 extra.
Yes, it's $600 to make your life a paint correction specialist.
Well, here's the issue, right? With matte paint, let's say a bird does happen to take a dump on your new Kia, right?
Right.
And then you go and you wipe it off. If you do it, like, too aggressively, you will shiny up the matte paint.
Yes.
And you're going to have a shiny spot on the matte,
yes.
Which is going to look, like I said, 150,000 miles from now, pretty
right.
Pretty bad when you've done that all over the car.
And then you have to repaint the whole side of the car to get it to match.
Same problem with bugs, I take it.
I didn't ask about bugs, but I did ask about bird poop, and they said you got to get
now,
it
off
there.
What color is it? The
shadow gray. It's like a dark gray.
Like a laptop, kind of like your laptop.
Yeah, a little darker than that, but
yeah.
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah, but it was a really good car. It has a curved digital instrument cluster in the top end trims.
Oh,
Hyundai
really?
And Kia do something really bizarre, though. They do this thing where if you want wireless Apple CarPlay and wireless Android Auto, you have to get the base model. So you have to get the small screen if you want the wireless functionality. If you get the big screen and the curved displays, they look fantastic, but then it's wired Apple CarPlay and Android Auto. Yep, and we kept grilling them, and then they got grumpy, and they said, we're not answering any more questions on the subject.
That's interesting, actually.
So I'm going to do a little bit of a rant here, guys, because I've been driving our long-term Hyundai Santa Cruz. And by the way, I really like that car. It's surprisingly much more trucky than one would think. You know, it's supposed to be kind of a lifestyle car, right? So the Santa Cruz is a little trucklet that competes with the Ford Maverick. Hyundai was kind enough to loan it to us for a year, so it's become kind of our shop truck. And I took it to the airport last week twice to go on, you know, various different programs, including the Z and the C class, which we'll get to. But we've got not the top model, but the one underneath it. You know what model that is, Tom? You know what the official name of that spec is?
It's oh yes. So we've got we have the SEL Premium.
Yep.
Which is I think it goes SC, SEL, SEL Premium, and then Limited.
So I'm on the highway, and I'm you know, curious to see how good the driver's assistance package stuff is, right? So normally when you've got like let's say you have a Tesla and you've got autopilot. You hit one button and the car stays in its lane, and then it stays at the given speed limit, whatever speed limit you want. And then it has also proximity control or automatic distancing control. So if you come up to a car or truck, it'll slow down to keep you, you know, that same distance behind it. And for some reason, this Santa Cruz has only two of those three things. So it'll keep you in your lane. It has cruise control, but it doesn't have the proximity distance control.
Well, it doesn't have adaptive cruise control.
It doesn't have adaptive cruise control. So I found that to be relatively dangerous, because now I'm assuming that the car is going to brake when I, you know, come speeding up behind a truck. And guess what?
Well, that sounds...
It doesn't.
It sounds entirely like user error.
No, it doesn't.
Why would you expect it to have one but not the other?
Because they're kind of being packaged now, right? And every other car, even our Subaru that we had, right, the Crosstrek,
yes,
they're packaged as one driver assistance program, like autopilot on a Tesla.
Now I've got a.
But now there's three different systems, and one of them isn't there. And so you expect the vehicle to kind of drive itself, but it doesn't.
The two main ones, there's really two main ones. There's adaptive cruise control and lane centering. Those are your two primary highway adaptive systems, right? And what Tesla does is you have two different levels. You turn once for adaptive cruise control and twice for lane centering. So if you want lane centering, you have to have adaptive cruise control. And I actually think this is an advantage of the Hyundai.
I don't think it's dangerous.
With the Hyundai, you can drive around on other roads and still use lane centering, but still use your pedals.
Which I find extremely frustrating.
But I do like it a lot. Like, for example, going out to the ranch, you've got these long, kind of never-ending straight country roads,
yeah,
where I wouldn't use the adaptive function of cruise control because cars could pull out in front of you. But I do like having that peace of mind of lane centering just in case. So I actually do think it's a really handy thing, and very few vehicles offer the ability to disconnect the two.
I disagree. I think it's dangerous. I think you're expecting the car to slow down when there's a slower vehicle ahead of you, and it just balls right into it.
But why would you expect that to happen?
Because
I mean, you would expect it to happen.
Because the car is just driving itself, right? To me, driving itself means that it's steering itself,
it's
right?
It's not driving itself. I mean, it still is level two. You still have to have your hand on the wheel at all times.
But it's approximately driving itself, right? So it'll go around bends on its own. And
not really. If you go any more than like a 10-degree bend, it turns off. So you got to be – it's really an assistance feature.
I'm just saying, Tommy, you expect a car to drive itself, and you just automatically expect that for a car of $35,000 that has that feature would always also have the adaptive cruise control, which it doesn't. And so, you know, you're kind of driving along and you're like, oh, there's a car in front of me, a truck. I think it's going to slow down. And next thing you know, you're almost hitting the thing because it doesn't slow down.
Well, that's because you're using the system wrong. I mean, the reason you're expecting...
Imagine this. Whoa. Take a big step back there, Gungadin. You know that
you are using the system.
I hate that when you blame the victim instead of the criminal, or the disease, right? This
right.
To me sounds a lot like, oh, you know, you wouldn't be as fat as you are if you ate less, you know. I mean, that, so take a big step back there before you say I'm using the system wrong.
Well, you are, first of all, you're relying on it way too heavily as a self-driving system. It's only an assistance feature.
I am not relying.
And
on it.
And I also think you are not a good person to talk about this. You know why?
Why?
Because you drive every loaded car on the market that has adaptive cruise control. So you have gotten painfully used to it.
Tommy,
but if you,
did you
can I finish what I'm going to say?
Yeah.
Can I please finish?
No.
If you gave it to someone like my mom, who has never used adaptive cruise control, she wouldn't think twice about it.
Did you hear what I just said?
What?
I said our $23,000 Subaru Crosstrek had it.
Sure.
$23,000. And every Toyota, every Honda, they all come standard with it now as part of Toyota's 2.0.
Yep.
Right? So I am not driving the Lamborghinis of the world, as you're implying, that automatically have it. I'm talking about a $23,000 Subaru Crosstrek that has it.
I still think you'll find there's a lot of folks out there that's never once touched adaptive cruise control, and they wouldn't expect it to break.
And that would be me.
Yeah,
and I was waiting for the moment to jump in.
Please do, because you have a Crosstrek.
I do. I have a brand new 2022 Crosstrek Sport, and it's got the eyesight, all that standard. I tried it. I don't like it.
I call
me old school. That's fine. I like to drive.
I agree.
I like to be in control.
I
don't like, even when I was a teenager learning to drive, I didn't even like cruise control.
Yeah.
Standard cruise, I just like to be in control of the vehicle.
No,
simple.
I like the lane centering because on a long trip it kind of helps you out just a little bit. But when I'm on a road trip, I don't use adaptive cruise control because I had a really bad experience with it once. And ever since then, I don't
trust
it.
You can't just throw that out there. What happened?
Well, you had a similar bad experience. It was in a Tesla and it went into full emergency braking because the adaptive cruise control thought an overpass was a wall. And you almost got rear-ended, right? And ever since then, I don't really trust the someone else, a computer, to be relying on the brakes.
Tommy, I trust me.
Yeah, I agree. I trust Jay, too. We need Jay assist.
So, Jay, you want to drive me to the airport next time?
I just think it's a slippery slope because if you start relying on this stuff as full driving technology, that's when you're going to get into the big accident.
Autopilot, full self-driving.
Yes, exactly.
Those are going great.
That's horrible. I think
no problems whatsoever.
Terrible piece of marketing. Yeah, exactly right. So I'd like to be able to disconnect adaptive cruise. Now, to your point, if it wanted to be competitive with Toyota, it should have standard adaptive cruise. Hyundai's kind of funky like that. I think it has standard lane centering, if I remember right. Actually, I know it does because I was just in a base Elantra that had standard lane centering but not adaptive cruise. So it's kind of funky that they go that way.
I'm just telling you, Tommy. You know, don't blame the victim, blame the technology.
Well, the government would blame the victim. It's worth noting.
The government actually will blame the driver.
Yes, which is what you call the victim. You're the driver in that.
Right.
Your insurance company.
But hold up here a second. Hold up, gentlemen. I wager that there will be people who will, using the system, potentially or definitely rear-end another car because they will be expecting, right, for the car to slow down when you're having the steering wheel steer for itself, and it won't, and it's going to create litigation. I'm just telling you, oftentimes when we see a problem, we get to see it first, and then we wait a little bit, and then next thing you know, there are stories out there where the thing has actually done the thing that we're afraid of.
Have you seen any stories?
Well, it's too early yet.
No, it is not. That system's been around for quite a long time.
Because you have to have the complete proliferation of.
But here's the thing. I mean,
it's just starting to proliferate right now.
I'm not so sure that because Hyundai's have been using this exact system for quite a number of.
No. I'm not saying Hyundai owners. I'm saying let's say you had like Jay has, Crosstrek, and you're used to having the system also have as part of the suite of. I'm doing air quotes here, self-driving technology, you're used to having it slow down when there's a car in front of it, and then you get in the Hyundai and you turn it on and it looks and smells and feels just like the other one, right? The only thing that's missing is it doesn't have the little icon that shows you how far you want to stay behind the car in front of you. So you turn it on, it starts steering for itself, cruise control sets itself, and you're just happily driving along, paying attention, and then there's a slower truck in front of you and bam!
Well, important note, cruise control doesn't set itself. You have to tell it to turn it on.
Yeah, course.
I don't think it's going to be a big issue.
Right.
And I think if it is an issue, that is the driver's fault. Because at the end of the day, it's a driver's responsibility.
It is the driver who engaged that system.
They are in full control of that automobile. And it's their job to be.
When Hyundai's attorneys call you up because they've listened to this podcast and there's litigation and you could be the expert person who testifies that it's the driver's
fault.
But don't some of these cars have like in airplanes like these little like black boxes full of data?
Yes, they
absolutely like if
do.
You do
yes.
This goes to litigation and the owner says, hey, I used the system correctly.
I mean,
look
when Tesla's
black box. Yeah, exactly.
When
look
Tesla's
Tesla.
Crash, right? Is it the company that gets in trouble or is it the driver?
There's so much litigation around there right now.
But usually it goes to the driver at fault, and that's why Tesla has that little disclaimer, right?
There is a lot of litigation, and there's in fact a candidate now, this is the latest news, running in California only on Tesla self-driving. That is the candidate's only...
It doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, only platform, basically saying that Tesla has built and created a vehicle that is dangerous and should be legislated. There's a lot going on around this. Anytime you have new technology, obviously, it takes time for people to adopt and adapt to it. It takes time for it to proliferate throughout the entire car market. You know, the average person is not driving a new car, obviously, right? They're driving older cars. But if I found it to be disconcerting, and I was paying attention, and I think it's gonna create, or will potentially create, issues. Anyway, we've certainly, you know, beat that dog to death.
Well, the other thing too, you have to consider is, doesn't that Santa Cruz have automatic emergency braking? So even if you were coming up on a truck and you forgot, wouldn't it slam on its brakes?
It has automatic emergency braking.
Yeah.
I think it's up to... I'm not sure.
Forward collision avoidance assist.
I'm not sure. Does it work up to, like, highway
speeds?
It
should work at any speed. Yeah, because the Mini started to freak out the other day when I pulled up on a car too fast
did
on
it?
The highway.
I don't know. Maybe it'll...
Yeah, it didn't hit the brakes, but it did go into the full...
You know what I really hate, though, is when the system, like, the lane centering takes effect a little prematurely.
Yeah.
You're like... a few centimeters away, and all of a sudden the steering wheel just
it's interesting.
Goes right back.
And here's where it also gets confusing, because there's two different technologies at play here. There's, like, lane keeping, right, which will nudge you back if you start to leave the lane.
Yes.
And then there's lane centering, which is designed to keep you in the middle of the lane for kind of the assistance side of it.
All right, so what you're saying, Tommy, is if it has – we're just speculating, so let's not – please don't. If you're an attorney and you're representing somebody who got in this accident, please don't.
So here's let me tell you what Hyundai calls it. So there's lane keeping assist, which warns you through audio and visual cues if your vehicle drifts out of its lane. And then there's what we're talking about, which is called highway drive assist, which is the thing that keeps you centered in your lane. Or is that lane follow assist? Using the front view camera to detect this features assists the driver's steering. That's lane. It's
so
very
many
confusing.
Here. It's hard to keep track of what.
Okay, so if you play this out logically, right? So you're saying it's got autonomous braking, right?
Yeah.
All right, so you're driving along and you don't have adaptive cruise control. Because the car doesn't have it, but it's got lane centering and it's got cruise control.
Yeah.
So you're driving along and you expect the car to brake. And you pull up behind a truck, and the car doesn't brake until emergency.
Yes, that could happen.
Emergency braking.
Yes.
Right?
Right,
in which case, the little old lady driving the CRV behind you slams into you.
Yes, that's correct.
Exactly.
But that's correct. There's a possibility. But
right, because you just slammed on your brakes.
Right.
But she should have kept distance.
But why are you relying on the car to do your braking when you don't have adaptive cruise control? That's just stupid.
I expected it to do it, and it wouldn't.
Well, that's your fault. You should have paid more attention. It doesn't have any of the features that it should have for adaptive cruise. It doesn't have the distance control. There's no way to adjust the distance.
Right.
So that should have been a good hint to you. Huh? This car doesn't have adaptive cruise control.
I'm just saying, Tommy. You know, I'm pretty good at technology, and this came as a bit of a surprise, and I found it a little disconcerting.
We got to get you out of S classes.
No.
Uh-huh.
Or Hyundai Santa Cruz.
We gotta get you into more.
A Miata.
Yeah, get you into a Miata. Exactly.
That doesn't have.
Just drive it.
In other news, I finally washed the car,
and
I was curious to see if that tonneau cover actually was waterproof.
Right.
So I drove it through a car wash, and then afterwards I opened it up, and it was pretty waterproof. There was just a little bit of dripping, but I felt like if I had my luggage in there, it would have been okay.
Well, is that waterproof then?
No, it's water resistant.
Yes. I was going to say, if you were in a submarine and there was just a little bit of dripping, you'd probably be pretty alarmed.
But it's got this built-in cover, right? And you wonder if you're, let's say you're going to the airport and you're picking up your friend and your friend's friend, right? And there's three of you and there's no room for luggage. You throw it in the bed of the truck. If you can actually use that cover on a day like today where it's raining. And I think you might be able to. So I was pretty impressed. There was like a little drip of water that got through, but not bad.
Is it tonneau cover factory OEM?
Yeah,
or
it's OEM. It comes from the factory.
That's
like
good
that.
Good to know.
Yeah, it's a good system. It's a really good little truck. They did a good job.
Yeah, we've been using it actually as a truck.
And it's equipped with a really good brake pedal, which I recommend you use more frequently.
Well,
it works fantastic.
So Jay and I, we're doing this new series where we're going to try to build our own E28 M5. You want to talk about that?
Yes.
That's the first generation of M5. And Tommy, we've come up with a name for it.
Okay.
This was Jay's idea. Jay, what's the name for the series?
I actually already forgot. I'm sorry.
Did you
that was like a week ago.
Did you know that when that car came out,
uh-huh.
which was I think in 84,
yes.
it was the world's fastest sedan?
Oh, that's right.
Okay.
So we're going to call the series the world's fastest sedan.
Okay.
Which it was.
Well, it's going to be about as fast as like...
35 years ago.
Yeah, an entry-level RAV4 ordered on it.
No, it's not going to be as fast as an entry. It's got a 280 horsepower engine, which is
a
RAV4 Prime. Yeah.
No, it was zero to 60 in like 6.5 seconds originally.
Yeah, RAV4, this is allegedly.
But no, this is 1987.
This is a long time ago.
Like, just to give you.
I have a theory.
Hold. Let me explain this before you have a theory. So we bought a BMW, a 1987 BMW M5. Except it wasn't. Do you want to tell the story of this car?
Yes.
Okay.
It's
tell
a 535.
Yes.
With an M Sport package.
A Japanese domestic.
Which we never got in the States. But basically, it looks like an M5. It's got the M badging on it. It's got the body kit. It's got a limited slip rear diff. But it has the M30 straight six, which only had like 180 horsepower, versus the Japanese M5, which should have had like 256.
So in Japan, because it's more prestigious, the expensive cars are left-hand drive, which is good because when you bring it to America, then it works better. You can go to the Starbucks.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so somebody brought it in thinking it was an M5, and then they were very sorely disappointed to find out that it wasn't.
Right.
It looked like an M5, but it wasn't.
Well, they should have looked at the engine and they would have figured out immediately.
They wrongly assumed and they got stuck with it.
So then they sold it to somebody here in Boulder. This guy in Boulder bought it.
Yep.
And he decided, because the Japanese car had an automatic, that he was going to actually transplant the automatic with the manual. So he put in the manual. And this guy named Mark, who is a master BMW mechanic, did the work for him.
Yep.
And then he decided that he wanted to – well, his wife decided that he needs to either keep his BMW GS or the M5-ish looking car. And he wanted to keep the GS, so he sold it to us for $18,000.
Yes.
And we decided that since we're already two-thirds of the way to an M5 – by the way, you know how many M5s they built? I looked it up.
2,000.
Yes, 2,000.
Yeah.
There's only 2,000.
2,441, I think.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah, it's about just over 2,000.
Yeah.
We thought, why not like build our own M5? And so I talked to Mark, the mechanic, and I said, we need to find an engine for it. And there were two different engines. You want to talk about the engines that went into it?
Yeah, I mean, there were – so in the M5s, there was the M88, which was like the European engine, which was basically a non-catalyst engine with 280 horsepower.
It had higher compression.
And it had but it had a single row timing chain, which was a big flaw in it. And then in the US, we got the S38 version of that motor, which had a dual row timing chain, and then it had a catalyst, and it was like 250 horsepower. So it was down like 30. And then that S38 engine continued into the
– second generation.
Yeah, the E34 M5 as well.
Or the M6, which came along.
Yes, that would have been the same
engine. So if it had been American spec, it would have had another difference, and that is it would have had symmetrical headlights. So there's four headlights in the car, and the European ones had the inner headlights were smaller than the outer lights.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so we've got the European headlights, and we've got the European bumpers, which are cooler. So we've got the cool bumper, we got the cool headlights. And then because of Mark, we were able to find an original M88 engine, which potentially that car would have had, that was sitting at a shop in
San Diego
for like 15 years on the floor.
Well, you say it would have had it.
Yes.
The European one would have had it.
Would have had it, yeah, which was the one they imported.
The Japanese one, I think, would have had S38s because Japan had really strict emission standards.
I don't think they imported the first gen.
They may not have imported the M5 at all.
So the car we would have had with the bumper and the headlights would have had the M88 power plant.
Yes.
It wouldn't have had the American power plant.
Right.
And so we found one of these engines in San Diego. Mark found it for us, and it had been sitting on the shop floor in San Diego, and this is a long way to get back to the Hyundai, but we're getting there.
It'll make sense.
It'll make sense in a second. Yeah. So we found it, and we sent Alex and Case to go pick it up, which they did, and brought it back. And we paid $8,500 for that power plant, which seems like a lot, but I feel like M5s are probably going for like $50,000. So right now we're at $18,000 for the car and $8,500 for the plant. And then me and Jay loaded it up into the Santa Cruz, which Mark thinks the engine weighs about 500 pounds.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did really well. So we put it in the Santa Cruz, couldn't shut the tailgate, and drove it to Mark where we unloaded it. And Mark immediately took the header off. And tell him what we found, Jane.
It was blue.
The header or the head?
The head, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
it was painted blue partially.
It should not be painted
blue. The engine
was
painted blue, which was, I guess that was because of a pretty well-known BMW tuner. But we found that actually inside it all looked pretty good.
Good, yeah, considering its age and it just sat for a long time.
But Mark said something which was a little terrifying, and it turned out to be, unfortunately, a bearer of bad news. He saw that the engine had no spark plugs.
Yeah.
So what do you think happens to an engine that sits by the ocean for like 15 years with no spark plugs?
Well, why did they take the spark plugs out in the first place?
No clue.
That's
idea.
Also an alarming.
We were puzzled too.
No
clue. We had no idea.
Yeah. So Mark took the engine apart
and
found out that the pistons were rusted.
Yes, that sounds about right.
And unfortunately, that's expensive. But fortunately, he knew the guy from the shop we bought it from, and he's going to cover the cost of either fixing or I don't know how they're going to fix the pistons, but they're going to redo the pistons. So we're going to have to rebuild the engine. But I kind of expected that.
Right. And we're still missing like a lot of wiring on it.
No, it came with the wiring harness.
The wiring harness is there.
Yeah. And there's something else cool.
Right.
Tell them what happened when we took apart, Jay, the little box, the little computer box.
It was still functional.
Yeah, but what was in the box? What was cool about it? It had a special little chip.
Okay. Oh.
Jay doesn't remember.
I don't remember.
So we took apart the little computer box, right?
Yep.
And inside was a chip. And guess what it said on the chip?
What?
Denon.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been shipped.
Very cool.
So Mark thinks that engine is probably putting out more like 300 horsepower.
So this is unfortunately one thing that will never be able to... So it will never be quite worth what an M5 will be
worth. Of course. It's a monster Frankenstein M5.
Like, did you know, where's the 5 Series built? This is an interesting...
Dinglefling.
But not the M5.
Where was the ding?
So ours was built in Dinglefling.
Okay.
And then they also built them in knockdown kits in Roslyn, South Africa. But all 5 Series were built in Dinglefling, except for the 5 Series, which was was hand assembled at a special motorsports plant in I can't even say the word. It's in Munich. It's
That's good enough.
München?
No.
You can say München.
The Prusenstrasse in Munich.
Prusenstrasse.
Yeah.
Well, where was the engine built?
I don't know where they built the M88s and the S38s.
So there are some other differences between ours eventually when we finish it. First and foremost, the M5 had this trick suspension. It was like a self-leveling suspension that everybody tears out of it because they all fail.
Okay.
And then the other difference is they had power seats. They had one of the first like power seats.
Oh, really?
And ours has manual seats, manual sports
and
seats.
And I think in North America, weren't all the M5s black on tan?
There was maybe two colors. It was black and white or something.
I think they were. No, I think all the M5s were black on tan.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to say that's true. Anyways, it'll be a fun series. But the Santa Cruz held the engine pretty well, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, drove fine. Like, I was in the front passenger seat. Didn't even feel like we were hauling something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And speaking of self-leveling suspension, the Hyundai Santa Cruz also has self-leveling suspension.
It does.
Yeah,
and the rear is pretty cool.
Yeah, so when we put 500 pounds in the back, that kind of went, and then it just, you know, was happy. It didn't squat a lot. And considering that truck has 1,400 pounds of payload, that's pretty impressive.
You know where the M88 came from, right?
Where?
The M1.
That's right. You're
yeah,
right.
Yeah, so that's another bit of trivia that Jay looked up. You remember, Jay, the only other quote-unquote exotic car that's a lower production car than the E28 M5 is what, Jay?
The M1.
M1.
There you go.
Yeah.
It's pretty special.
That's pretty special. Yeah.
Well.
Yeah. That's what Wiki says. You're going to argue with Wiki?
Yeah.
What?
Because the E36 M3 lightweight was fewer production.
Now you're looking at a model.
Like the Evo models, I think were probably.
But those are sub models. No, in general.
Oh, okay.
Right? The E28 M5 is the lowest production BMW outside of the original M1.
There you go. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is a cool. Even Mark was pretty impressed by
what he
saw.
Cool piece of trivia.
Yeah, and you know, it was pretty cool pulling that engine out, and we're going to do a lot to it. The one thing we don't have are the exhaust, the headers. We have the headers, but we don't have the headers.
Do
we have headers?
No.
Do we have headers?
I don't think it has headers.
I don't think we have those, no.
No, so we need headers and we need an exhaust. Mark suggested that we make it pretty free-flowing.
Okay.
I think that's a good idea.
Is he going to help us find
headers? Yeah, you can get them. You can get headers
for
it. They're expensive. They're like $2,000.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's pretty pricey.
And the coolest thing about that car, if you guys can't picture it, it's got those two little round exhausts that come out the back, and they're centered, right? So there's like these two little, let's say they're maybe like 50, half-dollar size exhausts that are, you know, stuck pretty close together that come right out the middle of the thing. And that's what makes it special in my mind, besides the fact that it's, you know, the world's fastest sedan.
Okay.
It's going to be a cool project, especially once it's done.
So the plan is we're going to like take the car we have, we're going to benchmark it, take it to the track, do a quarter mile, do 0 to 60, do 60 to 0 probably, and then swap the engine. And he said everything's going to work, including air conditioning, everything.
Nice. Very cool. Well, first we got to rebuild the engine.
Yeah, that's going to take a little bit of time.
That's going to take some time. Well, very cool. But the Santa Cruz held it around just fine, huh?
Yeah.
Good to hear.
All right. Jay, do we have some questions from our lovely listeners and viewers?
Yeah, we do. We have one here from Shelley. She has a few questions about the 2023 Toyota Sequoia. She's currently driving a 2005 Sequoia Limited. With a luxury package. She bought it new, loves it. And then last October, she ordered a 2022 Sequoia Platinum and was told that it would be 5 to 7 months before she would get it. And then in January, she was told she would not get the 2022, but the 23 model.
Yeah, sounds like Rivian.
Yeah, except they didn't change the price on her.
That's good.
That's good.
Well, so far, she was told that she would have the first pick from whatever the dealership receives, but now she'll be purchasing a vehicle that she has never seen before, and she would like to know what our impressions are of the 23 Sequoia. Specifically, will she be losing cargo room? She doesn't need the third row that often, and she just doesn't think that'll be a problem, but she still likes the Platinum. The Capstone just looks too over the top for her. And she basically just wants a comfortable ride for three adults on a daily basis. And they live in the San Diego area, so freeway driving is going to be pretty constant as well as around town. And she really wants our help.
Well, did you drive it?
I have not as much as seen a Sequoia in person, so I'm not going to be much help on this question.
Well, when the Tundra comes out, then there's a Sequoia because they share the drivetrain. So we know a lot about the Sequoia. I think, did Andre drive it already?
No.
So he's just going out to drive it.
Well, so Andre went to the launch reveal, though, so maybe we'll have him talk about it more on
the Talking Trucks. But we can certainly talk about the powertrain because it is based on the Tundra. What do you think of the Tundra? My biggest worry, Shelley, would be not the size. I think, they rarely make cars smaller. I'm not sure about the size, but I bet you it's bigger. You look like you're about to fall asleep, Tommy. You want to go out and grab yourself some Red Bull or something? Because I'm really having a hard time concentrating when you look like you're about to fall asleep over here.
I'm trying to figure out what to say about the Sequoia. To be honest.
Well, what do you mean? There's a lot to say. We've got the Tundra. We can talk about that.
Yep.
And it's identical powertrain, identical interior from the driver's standpoint.
Okay.
Identical, it's basically based on a Tundra. So what do you think of the infotainment in the Tundra? That was my biggest problem.
Yeah, it worked.
Yeah, but you had to log in.
It was honestly, I think it's going to be a fine SUV. I don't think it's going to, like the Sequoia has always just been like, bloop, right in the middle. It's going to be big. It's going to be comfortable. It's going to have pretty good room. It's going to have pretty good tech. And it's going to last a long time. There you go.
Okay.
That's about all I can say.
Well, how about styling wise? It looks like a Tundra with a top on it.
The like every other Sequoia.
People in the comments said that the
people Sequoia think the Sequoia looks better than the Tundra.
Than the Tundra, yeah. So people like the look of.
I just don't have a whole lot to add about the Sequoia. I hate to say it, but I've never been much of a Sequoia person.
So you're saying you're not a fan? Why don't you like the Sequoia?
I feel like if you're going to get a big SUV, the Tahoe is the best in class and always will be the best in class. I feel like it's never really been. Dethroned in that manner. I think they sell a ton of them, but for a reason. I like the way the Tahoes look. I like the way they drive. I like the way they make use of their space.
So according to Tommy Shelley, you're supposed to go out and cancel your Sequoia reservation and go get yourself a Tahoe.
Sure.
Is that what you're saying?
What?
Do you agree, Jay?
I don't know.
I don't know because
I don't like Sequoias very much.
Yeah, these Toyotas are bulletproof, man.
I mean,
you can just drive them forever.
But we don't even know that about the new one because they went away.
It's a Toyota.
Yeah.
What could go wrong?
It's got that twin turbo V6, right? Which hopefully is going to be very good, but we just don't have the data on it yet.
Well, we put 7,000 miles on it without any issues.
Yeah.
Look, Jelly, my suggestion would be go and test drive a Tundra, because it will be based on that. So the power will be very similar. And my biggest issue was, we just got the new Chevy ZR2, and I drove it all weekend, and I was blown away by how good the infotainment is. And
whether there you go. we like buy a Tahoe.
Whether we like it, it's a different system. The Tahoe doesn't have the newest.
Although the
version.
New Yukon, I think, has got the new. They just redid the Yukon,
but the Tahoe doesn't have. The one we drove does not have it. Anyway, infotainment is becoming much more important in the car driving, buying, owning experience. Frustrating. And I'll give you what
you
I mean by
you really didn't like that infotainment. And
no.
I think a lot of the issue
it
was...
It forced me to log in.
We had an early one. Once you log in, though, the idea is you never have to log in again.
Yeah, but they took some pretty big missteps. For instance, you know, if you wanted auto stop start, they wanted to make that as a subscription. So immediately...
No, it was a remote start.
Remote start was a subscription-based fee. So immediately I started thinking to myself, the reason they're making you log in is because they want to force you to buy things that once upon a time used to be complimentary when you bought a certain level of vehicle.
It sounds like she should get a Tahoe.
No, I'm not saying get a Tahoe. what do you think? Did you have a chance to drive the new Tundra, Jay?
No, I didn't have a chance, but I have driven a Yukon Denali last winter.
There you go. And did you like
no,
it?
No, not the Denali. I'm sorry, the AT4.
Did you like it?
Yeah, that had the 6.2 liter V8.
That thing's a beast.
And I drove that out to Breckenridge to go snowboarding one day, and the roads were a little choppy, and man, I was confident driving that.
Toyota does a really good product, and I think that the Tundra is a very solid, middle-of-the-line kind of truck in the lineup. And I think the Sequoia will be probably just the same.
So here's, like I said, the infotainment issue, right? Toyota's infotainment was bottom of the pack in terms of its usability,
right.
In terms
of
its...
It was not amazing.
It was not amazing. So they built their entire in-house team, so they didn't build it on... You know, Android Auto, right?
Mm-hmm.
What they did was they built it from the ground up, and they made it much better. But unfortunately, with the ZR2, it's gone the next level. And so right now, the current Toyota system is, like the truck itself in some extent, is at par with where, you know, the current set of technology is. But it's not where it's going. So I feel like because that's such an important part of the buying process, I think she should drive or test or play with the Tundra, make sure she's comfortable with that system, because I promise you it's going to be in the Sequoia. In terms of room, longevity, reliability, power, I think it's got all that.
No, sure.
And I like the design of it as well. I think it's a very good looking truck. And you're right, the Capstone edition is, the manufacturers recently have found out that there seems to be no ceiling in how much they can charge for very expensive. And so it's they're running out of different names to call the most expensive one. I think Ford has now three different levels of premium truck, right?
There's, yep,
like there's
limited,
King Ranch.
Limited King Ranch.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and now Toyota has 1794, now Capstone, and what's going to be above Capstone?
Okay, so what's the next question?
Yeah, actually, here we go. This is about the Ford F-150 Lightning range extending generator.
Okay, that's
so this is going to be good because we're going to be driving that F-150 Lightning really soon.
Shouldn't this be on trucks, though? She said this for Andre. This is a car show.
Yes, but this is a nerdy EV question, so I kind of wanted to dive into it a little bit.
All right.
So the question is...
let him read it.
Okay, you want to read it, Jay?
This is from Chris. He's trying to get an answer from Ford on this, and he just hasn't received a reply yet. Even with the manager in charge of the Ford display at a recent auto show, what he wants to know is, will Ford include as an option the gas/diesel generator disguised as a toolbox in the bed? Ford has a patent on this very item, and it would make his travel trailer towing much better than the F-150 or so miles with just the battery. He says he could travel all day instead of just going 2 to 3 hours, charge an hour, then another 2 to 3 hours, and then charge again.
All right, so this is an interesting concept. So there was a patent, I think it was a couple years ago now, maybe even last year, which was it looked to be some kind of range extender that fits into the bed, kind of like an accessory toolbox perhaps. And here's the issue with range extenders. Range extenders are a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is you got a fully electric vehicle, and then in an emergency, you can start up a small engine to get you to the next charger.
Like an i3.
But people think that you can drive on range extenders just like you would drive on any other engine. But the issue is a range extender is essentially just powering you down the road with however much power that range extender has. So as we found out with the BMW i3, it drove like a normal car on electricity. You could drive up to like 95, 100 miles an hour. It'd be very, very quick. And then when the battery dies, the range extender kicks on.
Which is a 600cc Kymco motorcycle engine.
But a lot of people expected it to drive like a plug-in hybrid on a range extender where you can still go 90, 100 miles an hour, still accelerate quickly.
And why is it a Kymco and not a BMW?
That's an interesting question.
Yeah, that's one. Hey, if you know the answer to that, why did BMW put a Kymco power plant into their
i3 instead of the design of the engine?
Because BMW Motorrad, right, has been around longer than BMW building motorcycles.
There's more to that story, though. Maybe it was like they needed a certain displacement and they didn't need they couldn't use a flat
engine.
Actually,
I'm probably wrong. I think motorcycles came after BMW because BMW started building airplane engines first, right?
Yes.
Aircraft engines.
That's correct.
Yeah.
No.
And then they were prohibited from building aircraft engines after the Second World War. So they had to go and do like motorcycles.
Yes, and then cars, I think, came in 1934. Yeah. But the issue with the range extender concept is essentially when you're running on the range extender, you're driving a vehicle with a tiny little engine. So with the BMW i3, you are no longer driving a vehicle that's fast and powerful. You are now driving a vehicle with a 2-cylinder, 34-horsepower engine, which means the top speed's about 55 miles an hour.
Unless you're going up I-70.
In which case, the top speed's about 24 miles an hour, as we found out.
Which is terrifying when trucks are passing you at 75 miles an hour.
So if you were to range extend an F-150...
It would be terrible.
It would be pretty bad, because the whole purpose of a range extender is to essentially limp you to the next charger. It's got a tiny fuel tank. It's just supposed to get you to the next charger. And I really don't think you could drive at all, especially towing. So his idea was he'd tow with a range extender. It's just not going to happen. No. Where a range extender could be useful is, say, driving around the i3, it would take an hour to fully deplete the battery, right, before you have to limp along.
Maybe 50 miles of range.
Maybe if you start the range extender right when you start driving, you could extend that hour to like an hour and a half or 2 hours of convenient driving.
So with the i3, the one we had was a 2014 that had like 50 miles of range, and the newest one got up to like 150.
No, ours was 84 officially.
Was it?
And then you can get up to like 150.
But we never got 84. It was pretty...
I got 75 about what I would get on it. Yeah.
Before the range extender would kick in.
But the idea, in theory, with a range extender, you could turn the range extender on right away when you have a full charge and just basically prolong the inevitable.
But there are other problems.
Well, legislation.
No.
Yes, legislation. You couldn't do that on an i3 because the U.S. government said,
yeah,
hey...
Yeah, I don't want to go into that. That's a whole...
Well, it's an interesting conversation. It's more interesting than the Sequoia.
All right.
Anyway, so, what were you going to say?
Now that you opened up this can of worms, we have to go into this.
So when BMW brought the i3 into the States, they wanted it to be classified as an electric vehicle, right?
Right.
Yes. And not a plug-in hybrid. And you got huge advantages in California for doing that. So in order for it to be an electric vehicle, it had to go further on electricity than it could potentially go on gasoline, which meant that they shipped it with a 2.5-gallon fuel tank. And then they had the software limited to 2 gallons. So it would go just ever so slightly further on electricity than gasoline.
Yeah, but there was more to it than that.
And then what you could do in Europe, on the European i3s, you could turn on that range extender whenever you wanted to. Here in America, you had to wait till the battery was completely dead.
You know what the sound of that? That's the sound of everybody clicking out of this video.
They've already clicked out long ago.
Because like the BMW i3 is just, everyone loved that BMW in America.
Well, it was the reason I keep going back to it is because to this day, it's the only vehicle sold in the States that was officially marketed as a range extender vehicle.
Can I get to my original point?
Sure.
The problem, and we found this out with the range extender, is that you have 2 powertrains and you basically have to service 2 powertrains. So if you have a Kymco engine in a BMW that doesn't run for a long time, our charcoal filter, for instance, which you have to have because it has gas in it, right, became somehow corrupt, and we couldn't, when the charcoal filter stops working, you can't open up the little flap on a BMW i3 to pour gas in, so then it's a very expensive trip to the car dealership to get it fixed.
So you've got
the battery you got to maintain, and you've got the engine power. Well, you got the battery, you got the motor, and the engine you have to maintain, and that gets expensive.
In theory, it shouldn't be that expensive, but it was because it's an old BMW. But you could, to clarify, when the charcoal filter failed, we could still put gas in it. We just had to manually pop it.
Well, you could.
You have to go through the emergency release.
So, to clarify some more, there's a little button in the car that when you push it, it opens up the flap normally, right?
Right.
But to do the emergency, you had to open up the
hood
and then pull a lever manually. So every time you wanted to fill it up, you had to actually pop the hood.
But that would be – that's not the fault of the range extender. That's the same thing on a plug-in hybrid. You have two powertrains.
Well, the fault is that you've got two powertrains that you got to maintain.
Right.
Which is a pain in the butt.
Anyways, it was an interesting question. And the other thing, too, is you'd be astonished at how large of an engine you need to provide such a small amount of electricity. So, for example, look at the size of generators, right? If you go to, like, your Home Depot and you get yourself a normal-sized little 110-volt generator, the thing's going to weigh, like, what, 50, 75 pounds, and it's a pretty big unit. And then you go to plug anything in, and you quickly realize a couple of blenders, and that thing's maxed out. So then you go and you go crazy like we did. We had a $5,000 Honda generator for a while. Do you remember this thing?
I remember, yeah.
It was, like, 200-and-something pounds.
Right,
it needed, like, three people to lift it. This thing was, like, half the size of
a
truck bed.
5,000-watt
unit.
Yeah.
And a 5,000-watt generator might be able to propel a car at like 10 miles an hour, maybe.
That's why the F-150 with the onboard power, right, is such an efficient generator. It generates a lot of power.
Well, because you got a twin turbo V6.
You've got a 350 horsepower twin turbo V6.
But then you can't drive on electricity for any meaningful amount of time.
Right, but it does generate a lot of power.
So in order for you to generate a lot of power, you need a hell of a lot of gasoline engine.
And it'll do so. Did you know it uses about a gallon an hour?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, the new F-150
Lightning. 36-gallon tank will last you about
the new electric F-150 you're going to go drive tomorrow.
Yeah.
Has like 11 kilowatts of onboard power, so that's even more.
Yeah, if you guys are listening to this today, which is Monday, I'm going to go drive the Lightning tomorrow. That's because Andre's going to drive the new GMC Ultimate Denali and the AT4X. So we're going to have a lot of great truck content over at TFL Trucks. So I'll have a walk around of the Lightning. Tommy, I think Andre's going to have a walk around of the Ultimate and the AT4X. So a lot of great stuff on truck. But let's get to the vehicle that I just drove last week, which is a new C-Class. There it is. What do you think of the styling?
It looks a lot like the previous one.
Yeah, is it the new one or is it the old one?
It's like, I thought it was a refresh at first. But
yeah, I thought so too, but apparently it's all new.
Yes.
Did you know it's 3 inches longer?
Now I do.
Thank you for telling
us. And did you know two of those inches are at the hood and only 1 inch is in the rear? So you get, out of those 3 inches, you get about 1 inch more leg room in the rear, and that is according to Alex on Autos, who was on the program with me.
What about the wheelbase?
I don't know. I didn't ask about the wheelbase. He said they put 2 more inches. He said also, and me and Tommy had this interesting conversation, Jay, and let me see. I'm going to ask you this question because Tommy corrected me, so let's see if you can think of this. So Mercedes said that this is the very first four-cylinder, two-liter turbo that is a mild hybrid. In other words, it has a 48-volt system.
Yes.
And over breakfast, Tommy corrected me, and he said there was a previous vehicle that had a two-liter turbo hybrid. What is that vehicle?
From Mercedes?
No, from any other manufacturer.
Silence now.
Yeah. Tommy corrected me, and he was right. We actually had this car for a very short time.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of stumped here. But I'm really curious.
All right. It was the, it is the Wrangler, right, that launched. And I think, actually, this is a good point. They're not super, well, they are wrong, but so the 2 liter turbo in the Jeep launched as a mild hybrid, the e-torque system, and now if you go out and buy one, it doesn't have the e-torque anymore.
Yeah.
So I think they got rid of it.
Yeah, we got rid of ours too.
Yeah.
Why did they get rid of it, do you think?
Because we got rid of ours.
That's the reason.
It had issues.
Yeah, it was not fantastic.
Yeah, it lit up like a, the treble lights lit up like a Christmas tree.
And then charging at the top of Mount Evans. Yeah,
that's not great. So you think the new C-Class, Mercedes has it worked out?
Well, so what Jeep does is they do like the stupid belt-driven alternator. Which is just like a big chunky motor that kind of sits on top of the engine driven by a belt. Mercedes integrates their EQ boost system into the engine transmission in like a sandwich system, and that's a much better way of doing it. So, I'm excited to see what you think and what it drives like. I can't wait to watch your video coming up here shortly.
Yeah, so, there's that old saying, if a car is very successful, then the next generation is an evolution versus a revolution, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mercedes said that, guess how many previous generation C-Classes they have sold? I'll let you guys take a guess, both of you. Go for it.
1.2 million.
I'm going to give you a hint, Jay.
Yeah.
You are off by over a million.
200,000.
What do you say, Jay?
2.2.
2.7 million.
There you go. Wow.
Yeah, it's one of the most popular models.
There you go. It's pretty impressive.
Does it sell better than the E-Class?
I don't know how many E-Class they sell, but at 2.7 million, I'm sure
that's a lot of cars.
That's a lot of cars.
Especially these days for
that's
got to
be global, right? That's
global, yeah, global, yeah. You know, design-wise, interior and exterior, it's got, you know, a lot of, like, S-Class in it, right? So Mercedes was trying to...
Yeah, it's got that, like, floating console thing with the big round vents. I think it looks good. It's a nice design.
I like all the blue lighting trim. I mean, that's not new in a Mercedes, but it still looks really
good. No, it looks good.
Yeah, they were trying to push the narrative of it being a baby S-Class.
Baby S-Class.
Yeah, yeah.
There you go.
But, of course, like a baby S-Class, it's not inexpensive.
Yeah, what's the starting price?
I'm not sure if that's embargoed or not, so I'd rather not say...
Okay.
If at all possible, until the video comes out, which will come out May 16th, I believe.
All right. Well, you have to stay tuned for all that.
But you can see a lot of S-Class in the design of the vehicle.
Yeah, it's nice. It's very minimalist, but very refined. I like this new, like, dual-bladed steering wheel that Mercedes has been doing all over the place. I think
it
looks really
cool. Is that a flat-bottom
cool.
steering wheel? I can't tell from here.
It is a flat-bottom steering wheel. Yeah. You know, I'm not – the one thing I got to say, I'm not impressed with those. They're not really haptic, but look at those, like, buttons – that control, for instance, the seating positions, right?
Mm-hmm. They used to move, and now they don't move.
They used to move, and now they don't move. You got to kind of like just and I'm always trying to push them, and you don't push them.
Yeah, I don't like that very much. It's very frustrating.
It is very frustrating.
I've used those as well. Yeah, the new system's not very good.
It does have some pretty cool cameras. It's got that 360-degree bird-eye camera.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, this, the one I drove at least, had complete, you know, both proximity, not proximity, what do you call it? Adaptive cruise control.
And lane centering.
And lane centering.
There you go.
And it had it all. And it you know, didn't have one of the two or three missing.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
Be sure to stay tuned for that video coming up. Do we have anything else you want to mention?
I don't know. How about you, Jay? What else you got going on?
I drove the Infiniti QX55 over the weekend.
Yeah, tell me about that.
You know, it looks really good inside and out. The 2.0 turbo engine is kind of a disappointment in this car.
Really?
It's just,
why?
Well, it compared to, you have like, what is it, go up against like a BMW X4, Tommy? Is that about right?
Yeah, exactly like right. That. Yeah, so this is like the coupe version of their...
QX50.
QX50, yep.
Right. It just, you know, I'm accelerating on the highway. Perfect driving conditions, and it just felt heavy.
Hmm.
It was sluggish, and you're like, you know, this engine is capable of so much more.
Well, it also is a CVT, right? I don't understand this whole what you call step CVT thing, because they're trying to simulate a standard automatic.
Yeah, that's what's called.
So they
I know, but it's
fake gearing.
It's clearly fake. So why not just embrace the CVT-ness?
Because people don't like that.
But it's more efficient. It's probably faster. Just to let it drone.
Nissan has created this like step that makes a CVT sound. Like,
well, a lot of companies do it too.
A lot of companies,
but also honestly,
I think Subaru does it as well, if I remember right.
Yeah, Subaru, but yeah, it has that in my Crosstrek. Yeah. But that Crosstrek costs an awful lot less than that QX55.
Yeah,
for an Infiniti at that price, I can't remember. I mean, you're talking at least $55,000 or so.
Right.
I mean, you shouldn't be having a CVT. You should be having at least like.
Especially
like
in a model that's like supposed
automatic
to be sporty, right? It's kind of got some sporty looks around it.
It doesn't drive very sporty. It drives kind of like a heavy hunk of metal.
All right, well, let's wrap this up with probably the most eye-opening car that we recently drove and actually drag raced against the Tesla Model 3. So I got to go up to our new quarter-mile drag strip, which is actually an airplane field. And guys, we're bringing back, get this, Tommy, TFL Bids. I'm announcing it right here, right now.
Okay.
And the first car, if you've been going to our truck channel, you notice that we've got a new video series called Go Big.
Yep.
Where Tommy's driving a 1999 Chevy Suburban, right?
Yep.
And we are going to be auctioning that off for charity. Who are we going to auction that off?
Yes, so it's going to support the Colorado State University Drone Center. So all proceeds are going to go and support them, which is a fantastic little organization here. They're doing some really cool scientific research and all that. So all the proceeds from this auction are going to go to them. And it'll be live here pretty shortly, hopefully. So you'll have all of that information coming up very soon. But yeah, it's just going to be a way that if you like the vehicles, you've seen the videos, you can potentially bid on it and potentially own the vehicle as well. So very cool stuff.
Yeah, and the reason we're doing this is because they're letting us use their their drone testing aircraft strip for drag racing. So we wanted to thank them because we're doing a lot of fun videos out there, drag racing, all kinds of things, including trucks. But we recently had a chance to drag race the brand new BMW i4 M50. Which is an all-new electric 4 Series BMW that looks like a regular 4 Series, except if you look close, you'll note that it doesn't have exhaust pipes. And so we thought it'd be fun to match it up against its direct rival, which is the which is the Model 3 Performance. And that video is up on TFLAV or alltfl.com. I won't tell you which one won, but I got to tell you, I was super impressed by that BMW. It was like the first electric car that wasn't kind of Tesla funky. And I'm not saying Tesla funky is bad. Tesla funky to me means you've got two steering wheel controls and you've got a big screen and it's very minimalist. This has a regular interface that, you know, most people might be familiar with. You got to review the BMW, Tommy. What'd you think of it?
Well, basically, BMW has a two-pronged approach on their newest EV. So there's the i4 and the iX. And the iX is kind of going for the Jetsons car appeal, where it's got, you know, the crazy materials and the weird design and all of that. And the i4 is going for, like, the gasoline enthusiast that just happens to want an electric car. And I loved it. It was fantastic. It had tons of horsepower, tons of torque. I think, like, 480-something horsepower. 0 to 60, we measured at 3.7 seconds using launch control. It was the beautiful thing to drive with the classic BMW driving dynamics. It was very planted in the corners. We had the 20-inch M-style wheels with the high-performance tires, and this thing just stuck in the corners. Very nicely sprung, too. Not too soft, but also not too firm. It definitely changed a lot depending on the mode. So when you go from like sport mode into comfort, the car really changes its character a lot. And then in sport mode, there's also a boost function and a launch control. But the interior quality was great. I like the curved screen. I actually love the new iDrive 8 system, brand new iDrive, way better than all the previous models. And it was just fantastic.
Yeah, $77,000.
Yep, it's expensive. Yep.
And there's another interesting question that we had and we can't answer, but we'll throw it out to you guys, see if you can answer this. So, Tommy, you just said it has a boost feature, right?
Yep.
So the way that it works is there's a little graph that says boost, and when you put it in sport mode, you have a certain amount of boost. In other words, almost like a certain amount. I think it's got, 500? How many horsepower? 500 and...
Well, I think it's 486, isn't it?
I think it's 500. Or is it torque, 500?
Torque might be.
Let anyway, 500-ish horsepower. When you see the little boost display, you get more power.
Oh, sorry, you're right. 536 horsepower.
Yeah, that's what I said, 536. I'm pretty good at memorizing numbers for some reason. Everything else I forget. Anyway, 536 horsepower. And so you get more power. And then as you use the boost, basically what you're getting is more battery power. And as you're getting more battery power, you're probably heating the batteries, all the cables, all the motors, and at some point you run out of boost and it doesn't derate itself, but it doesn't give you that extra power.
Sure.
But Tesla doesn't do that, right? They also don't do a launch control, right? With the Tesla Model 3 Performance, not the Model S, right? That's got a ludicrous mode and cheetah mode. I'm talking about the Model 3. When you floor it, it gives you all the power.
Right. Well, it's worth noting, though, if you push a Tesla too hard, they derate pretty quickly.
Right, that was my question. So, like when the Porsche Taycan came out, one of the things that Porsche said was you can do the same 0 to 60 run 10 times over and it won't kind of derate itself. So, the question is, do you need launch control? I mean, it seems silly. And do you really need this boost feature? Shouldn't it be just like Tesla that when you floor it, Jay, what do you think? You get all the power. Do you actually have to have a special boost feature and launch control to get the quickest acceleration? What do you like better? That kind of like, it goes to, I'm not going to, that's a cliche. You know what I mean? It's like that goes to 11 cliche.
Well, here, look, you've got two different. Okay. Here's the different strategies, right? Yeah. And if you accelerate an electric car enough times, the car will automatically...
Not a Porsche Taycan.
Allegedly. I'd really like to try that.
Okay.
But pretty much every other car I've been in, it will thermal throttle after enough... Because the stuff gets just too hot.
Right.
So you can do it the BMW way, where they give you the little boost bar, right? You can do it the Tesla way, where they really don't give you much, except they slowly kind of take away this little acceleration graph the more you do it.
Yeah.
Or you can do it the Ford Mustang Mach-E way, where they give you prison bars, and they just lock you out of it. So do you like the idea of like a Need for Speed turbo-style boost mode, or the other system where it just slowly and quietly lets you know that, hey, you can't get maximum acceleration?
The fun side of Jay likes the immediate boost mode,
yep,
because that's fun.
Yep.
But I was in the car with you when you were in the i4 when you I kind of hit the throttle,
uh-huh,
and it literally launched me backwards.
Yep.
But that's okay. That's fine. But I think on a day-to-day basis, the way Tesla does it might be what more people are used to.
The important thing to realize, and I think this is interesting, you're basically doing the same stuff. So whether or not you give a boost mode or whether or not you slowly take away acceleration, the end result is that the more you accelerate, the slower it's going to go. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
It's just a different way of kind of packaging it and giving it to the consumer.
Except Porsche is very... I trust Porsche, Tommy. I think Porsche, you said you kind of like... I think Porsche, if Porsche says it doesn't de-throttle thermal throttle, then it probably doesn't.
I believe them, but I mean, it's interesting. Like, look at other cars too. So for example, I-Pace, boost mode, right? You get a certain number of seconds of max acceleration. E-tron has that boost function too, right? Where you get a certain number of acceleration.
Right.
Gas cars do it too. A lot of gas cars will give you extra torque.
Actually, the e-tron is actually even different. You got to push through the pedal to get more power.
Yeah, there's a little like button at the bottom.
Yeah, there's a little button. So you floor it, and then you got to push on that little button to get extra.
Right.
So there are like four different ways really to do that now.
Right.
Or if you're in a Hyundai N product, right, which is an internal combustion engine, you have this little button on the steering wheel.
Yeah, that really is a turbo button. There's like an Engrin shift button.
There's so many, too many choices here.
Engrin, and you get like 10 seconds of overboost.
Now, what I like, I think the Porsche way is the best doing it. Just give me all the power all the time. But at some point, that's not feasible.
The problem with like the Model S Cheetah mode and Ludicrous mode is you got to basically thermal manage the batteries for optimum performance. And you sit there. When we did it, I think we sat there for like up to 20 minutes waiting for the batteries to heat up to give you their full beans.
Does that Model 3 though too, or is that
no? Just Model S.
Yeah, just Model S.
Yeah, so Model S performance does it. Model 3 just floor it.
Just get all of it. I talked to a guy who actually tracks Teslas at my autocross. This past weekend.
Yeah.
And he said on a typical racetrack you can get 3 to 4 laps before it'll start to derate itself.
Okay.
In a Model 3.
Yeah.
And then Tesla also uses something called track mode. So you can actually, there's this little display, and it shows you the temperature in the motors, the battery, and then also the wheels and the tires. And he said there are sensors in the motor and the battery that'll tell you, it'll go to yellow and then orange and then red.
I've seen somebody else do that too. I saw that.
Sure. But then there's also...
I can't think of what the manufacturer
is. There's also indicators on the brakes and the tires.
Yeah.
And I said, so how do they know the temperatures of the brakes and the tires? And he said, there's no sensors. It's just software. It says, if you're driving it at this hard for this long, brakes are probably pretty hot. And then it'll start to turn different colors.
I want to say it was a Porsche that... I'm sure. No, it was definitely a Porsche. It was a Porsche GT 4 RS. And they have little graphs that actually tell you the temperature of the brakes and of the tires, I believe. And these are real sensors. These aren't, I think these are real ones that give you that number.
Yeah, a bunch of people do it. I know, I've seen like high performance BMWs as well will tell you those temps as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's just like a fun little tidbit.
All right, last thing before we wrap this up. I had an interesting experience in our new Mini, and I wanted to kind of get kind of an etiquette question out there.
All right.
All right, so I'm coming out of the store, and I'm driving our little Mini SE, and I noticed that there's a young lady with a black Journey something in her back seat, and her door is open into the Mini. I mean, it's like it hit the Mini. Right?
How badly?
So it was the edge of the bottom of the door because the Mini is really short, and it put a little ding in the back of the Mini.
Oh, no.
So it's a ding. So, being a car guy, it hurts when you see somebody, basically open their door into your car. So I walked up to her, and I was trying to be very polite, but, at the same time express my concern that her car just damaged my car. So I said, excuse me, but do you know that your door, is in my car, is basically hitting my car? And she looked over. And then I looked inside, and she was putting a baby into a baby seat.
Ooh.
And then I was like, okay, so what is now my choice here, right? My choice is I could be like, do you want to handle this via an insurance company because there was a ding in the door?
Yeah.
Or do I just say, well, she's got a little baby. She had Iowa plates on her vehicle, so maybe she was visiting from out of town. She looked like she was, had her hands full with the baby. So I just said, you know what, never mind. And I drove off kind of licking my wounds. But I don't know what you do at that. I mean,
that's a tough call. I think you did the right thing.
You think so? Yeah. I mean, I felt bad for her. I could see. I remember when you were that age, Tommy.
Sure.
I could see, your mom doing the same thing.
It's listen, you have a young child, it's tough. And she probably didn't even realize it, and, you know, it's...
I don't think she realized it.
No.
There you go. I think that's your answer.
I think you did the right thing.
Cool. All right.
Solves that.
There you go. Well, thank you so much for listening.
You really tore into that etiquette question.
I don't do very well with these ethical dilemma questions.
Etiquette.
Yeah, etiquette dilemma questions. No, I think you did the right thing.
We'll just call it the baby dent in the
baby dent.
Just it's part of doing business. In other words, part of like owning a car and parking it in a busy parking lot.
Absolutely.
Yep. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's been quite the long hour and a bit.
All right, let me know, since Tommy's not helping out, thank you, Jay, for helping out, in the comments below, what you think was the right course of action, and, you know, what you do when somebody does that. Because, you know, oftentimes you get to your car, right, and you see the ding, but you never actually see the person who's done it, because they have either unwittingly or wittingly left the scene of
They'll just drive away as fast as they can.
Yes.
And as always, check out alltfl.com for all of our stuff in one location.
All right. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. And see you guys next time. Ciao.
Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now. Save big money.